Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 72 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me again today is Eric Deutsch from Escape from New York Minute and Flash Gordon Minute. Welcome back to the show, Eric.
Thank you.
It's yesterday we talked a little about candy. Today we'll get a little more candy, not too much, but today we'll have some interesting Christmas carols or Christmas tales to talk about. Who knows? We'll see what that is. So episode 72 begins with the SWAT guys continuing to get into position and ends with Robinson looking on sternly, trying to seem more important than he really is. So yesterday we mostly talked about candy, but besides that, we also dealt with the fact that the SWAT guys, who are not as professional as one would hope or expect them to be, are getting ready for their assault, and they run through these rose bushes, and today they continue to get ready for their assault, standing by the big Batman style spotlights. And then we get a shot of Theo, who is humming. Now, did you ever try and figure out what he's humming? Actually, no, we'll leave that. Actually, no. Okay. I'll let you answer that, but I'm not going to answer that real question till the very end. So what do you think? Do you know what he's humming?
I have not ever tried to figure out. I don't know what it is. But what I do want to say about it is that he's humming like he's like me at my desk job. I mean, it's like a day at the office for him, you know?
Yep, that's what it is. That is definitely true. So we'll wait until a little later. When we get to the script, I'll be able to tell you what he's supposedly humming. And then we can debate whether he's really humming that or not. You know, that I'm not sure about, but we shall see. So, he's looking intensely at the computer, you know, which we assume he's typing. You can hear the sounds of typing in the background or whatever. And, you know, they only show him for like 2 seconds, which is just like really weird why they're showing him do this. And then we see a large sign saying loading dock to the left. And then the camera pans really quickly to the right, and we see the limo now slowly driving through this empty parking lot, you know, and there's a big sign on above that says stop, exit Olympic Boulevard. So I mean, you're a New Yorker. I grew up also in on the East Coast and Midwest, so I don't know anything about LA or anything like that. But what do you know about Olympic? Do you know anything about Olympic Boulevard?
Very little. About 20 years ago, I was at a job where we had a couple of benefits that were out in Los Angeles, and so I had to spend like a few days for each of those benefits out in LA. And I remember at some point having to give directions, or maybe the hotel I was staying at or something was on Olympic Boulevard.
Right. So Olympic Boulevard originally was known as 10th Street, and it is one of the main roads of Los Angeles. It stretches from Ocean Avenue on the west end of Santa Monica all the way to East L.A. And it's further than Wilshire Boulevard or most other streets. So basically it's one of the longest streets in L.A. All right. Right. So what it has mostly 4 lanes across, right? And it doesn't cross any major attractions or sites, and therefore it usually has less traffic. You know, some of the other streets in the area are Wilshire Boulevard, Santa Monica Boulevard, Sunset Boulevard, all of those, there's a lot more reasons to drive on them, I guess you can say. I guess the reason to drive on Olympic is because there's no traffic.
You know, after that list of streets you just named, I want to start singing I Love LA by Randy Newman.
There you go. And basically it goes through West LA, Westwood, Century City, Beverly Hills, Hancock Park, Koreatown, Westlake, downtown LA, Little Ethiopia, Fairfax Avenue. And then it continues to go through Boyle Heights, East LA, Commerce, Montebello, and the easternmost point of the road goes to Pico Rivera, which is a small neighborhood that's around there. And it was they changed the name from 10th Street to Olympic Boulevard. Can you guess when?
I'm going to say 1984.
You got the right idea, but you got the wrong Olympics. The Olympics were held in 1932 in LA. So then they changed the name to that, and it was because it was the 10th modern event, which is actually even more interesting that they changed 10th Street to Olympic Boulevard, from that. So yeah, I found that quite interesting. Now there are a few landmarks on along Olympic Boulevard. You have the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, the Los Angeles branch of it. You have the Grammy Museum. You have LA Live, Loyola Law School, Sammy Lee Square, Los Angeles High School, and National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences headquarters. So apparently, most people are not going to those places, and that's why there isn't that much traffic on it. So basically, the limo continues to move slowly through the parking lot. Apparently, Argyle is trying to think of something to do. He's trying to think of a plan. How am I getting out of here? And at some point, he just parks and turns off the lights. Apparently out of exasperation. Apparently he doesn't want to, ruin. He doesn't want to use up all his gas or use up the electricity or something like that. And then we see him, and then they give us a great internal shot where he looks up into the rearview mirror, and what does he see?
The bear.
The bear, exactly. Do you know the history of this bear? Have you seen this bear in any other movies?
I have a feeling what you're about to tell me is going to make me think I have.
It is the bear in The Hunt for Red October, also directed by John McTiernan.
John McTiernan. There you go.
Yes. So my assumption is it belongs to McTiernan. That would make sense. Or to someone else on the production that appeared in both movies. But yes, that is the same bear that appears in the final scene of The Hunt for October.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Here's what I don't understand about Argyle. He clearly has finally given up. He realizes he's trapped in there. But considering, I know this is jumping ahead a bit, how he ends up getting out in the end of the movie, why not just do that now?
Maybe because he knows that there's a lot of cops around. I don't know. Maybe later he hears that everything's pretty much over, and at that point it's worth coming out. I mean, I don't know. It's a very good question. But I think the best answer is because it would not do the plot very well.
Well, yeah, I was looking for an in-universe answer, but
Yeah,
yes.
no, I realize that. Letting Argyle out earlier just doesn't help. Especially considering the fact that they didn't know how, when they were filming most of this movie, they didn't know the ending yet. They didn't know the whole thing about having the ambulance in the back of the truck, because when the truck shows up, there is no ambulance in the back. They have a magic ambulance that they're able to somehow pull out of a hat or pull out of a truck, and it just shows up. So Argyle looks at the bear and says, "Shut up." And he like exhales really deeply when he's doing it, and he just had enough. He just, which is really funny, because he just for the last 2 minutes tried to get out. That's it. It's not as if he's been trying for hours to get out, and now he's finally given up. He's tried the one or two exits, realized that he can't get out, and that's it. All right, I'm done. I got nothing better to do. No, he doesn't feel like partying anymore.
No, he's got to break. He knows he's stuck, so he's got to break his tension by himself. So how does he break his tension? He tells a stuffed animal to shut up.
Exactly. Because the stuffed animal is saying to him, "I told you so. You shouldn't have waited. You should." The bear is basically saying to him, "You should have taken me to see those mama bears."
Right.
So apparently, this bear wants that too. Who knows? And then the shot changes again. We see the SWAT team outside again, and then we hear the screaming, "Let's go!" And they're, the guys standing there, lights, they take off across the street and they run off towards the building. These guys look like they're in a little better shape than the other guys that we had seen earlier. You had four guys run across, and then we finally get McClane. You get to see McClane, and McClane goes, "Yo, you macho assholes, no!" And he bangs. I love how he bangs on the window as if that's really gonna help.
Yeah.
I'm 30 something floors up. I'm gonna bang on the window, and they're gonna hear me. And so, do you know the definition of the term macho? Like where that comes from? Like machoism?
Huh. No, actually, I do not.
Okay, so in Spanish, macho means male. So it's apparently a male ism, right? It's a sense of being manly or self-reliant, a concept associated with a strong sense of masculine pride or an exaggerated masculinity. The term originated in the early 30s and 40s, and it was best defined as people having pride in one's own masculinity. It's associated with a man's responsibility to provide for, protect, and defend his family. And machoism is strongly and consistently associated with dominance, aggression, exhibition, and nurturance. The correlation to machoism is found to be deeply rooted in family dynamics and culture. So, okay, that it's interesting. I don't know why McClane actually says that. Like, why would he call them macho assholes? It just doesn't really make that much sense. What do you think?
I mean, I guess he's using the word macho in the sense of toxic over aggression masculinity kind of thing of, why are these guys rushing in here to do this? This is a bad idea. They're letting their testosterone kind of run their thinking process.
Right, but do you think that it actually gives, is it something that you think McClane would have said? Because
Well,
we talked earlier, we talked yesterday about the fact that, we can relate more to someone like him. We can relate more to Uli who's hungry. While he's just sitting there waiting to shoot some people, things like that. And so, would you attribute this type of line to John McClane? Or does it sound like it's
Well,
something forced?
I mean, he is very cynical, and even though the character of John McClane has come to symbol, one of the main symbols in movies of, interest, ironically enough, considering this line, macho, a macho man, he is, portrayed in this movie, of course, like I'm sure every guest has talked about as the everyman. And so that the everyman is sort of the opposite of someone who is macho. So I don't think it's entirely out of character for someone that's being portrayed that way to say that.
Okay. That's fair. That's definitely fair. And so he starts banging on the window. Doesn't really do him much good. And then we get to see another shot of the four of them running across the grassy knoll, I guess you could say. And they have a great way of changing the shot to looking at it from a monitor. The wipe straight, of having them run across where we see it, that's being shot from, the camera by Jan de Bont, and then we next see them in a grainy type of shot, from the security cameras, where we see them running across. And then after a second or two, we get to see our good friend Theo again,
Who,
who
by the
is
way, is
he's
also eating.
I know, I know. Apparently Uli brought him a candy bar. Yeah, I did notice that also. I love the fact that
I love it.
he's doing something, whether he's
Yeah.
eating or whether he's chewing gum or something like that. I don't know, but he's
Sounds
definitely got
crunchy.
something
Sounds
there. Yes.
crunchy.
Yes. Now he starts his little diatribe here, where he goes, "All right, listen up, guys. So I'm going to first go through what he says, and then we'll talk about the shots changed. We get to see numerous people throughout while he's talking, but I'll just first give the whole line." So he goes, "All right, listen up, guys. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring except the four assholes coming in the rear in standard 2x2 cover formation." So I've always loved the line, the way that he does this, because on the one hand, we see Theo as the computer geek, but apparently he has some sort of military background. Because for him to be able to say that he can recognize that they're in a standard 2x2 cover formation, it means he's more than just the tech guy.
Right.
Maybe he was a tech guy in the army or something like that, but he's definitely familiar with that type of jargon, as he's doing it. So while he's talking, the shot changes. First, we get to see our old friend Uli eating a Crunch bar. We
Yes, we
mentioned
know what he
yesterday.
chose.
That's
We
right.
didn't know last week, yesterday's episode, what he chose. We now know what he chose.
That is correct. And we talked about the aluminum foil wrapping there. We can
Yep,
see that
we
very,
sure did.
very easily. And not only that, we see that part of the wrapper falls down and we can see that it says crunch. We can see part of the crunch. And then we see Eddie, who seems to have an itch in his ear because he like puts his finger in his ear and starts like tweaking his ear.
I mean, can we just talk about how, with Uli, with the candy bars and with Theo eating and turning this into a Christmas carol and Eddie picking his ear. I mean, these guys are about to engage in a shootout with charging police officers. Could they be more laid back and lackadaisical about what's about to occur? I mean, the guy's
Exactly.
cleaning out his earwax
That's
here.
right. The question is what ear does he have his earplug in? Is he listening to Theo
Yes.
in is he clearing out earwax or is he playing with his earpiece? Could be either of them. And then we get another shot of James on the roof again. Listening to the whole thing, listening to this bedtime story, and I think it's very important that we see James in that position. We'll talk about it later in the week, but it's very important that we see him on the top of the building. And then we see a picture of Hans, okay, who is in a darkened room. We have like part of the blinds opened. And so there's like little lines, we see from the bat lights downstairs, that they are shining on him. But he looks very, I don't know, he looks like someone slashed his face like with claws or something like that, with the way that the blinds, are making lines on his face.
Yeah, cool shot, cool effect.
Yeah, it really is. I really like the way that they do it. And then at this point, we see the SWAT guys once again, and we hear one of them say, "Okay, we're all set." And they get into position. And at this point, we get the final shot of the minute by seeing Robinson. Looking over and trying to figure out what's going on. I like the fact that they give us a close up of these SWAT guys. It gives us, beforehand, we joked yesterday about the SWAT guy, pricking his hand, and we talked about I mentioned the fact that some of them look like they're out of shape, but the four guys that they have here look like they're definitely up to the task. These are the guys that should be doing this type of thing. And they look very professional in what they're doing. You have that the main guy, is on his headphones saying that we're ready to go through. And then you got the other guys, ready to continue with what they need to do. And then we get a shot of Robinson just looking on. We see Al also looks, and we see the head of the SWAT team, and we also see, the guy who later will play Ricky in the third Die Hard movie also look on. The three of them are just looking on, or all four of them are standing there looking on as to what's going to happen. And we'll have to wait until tomorrow to find out exactly what's going to happen. Now, I mean, he mentions here the whole thing, 'twas the night before Christmas. So do you know the history of that Christmas poem?
I don't know the history of it. I mean, like almost anyone, I know the poem itself, but I don't know the history. It's called A Visit from St. Nick, right?
That is one of the names of it. It has numerous names.
Okay.
It's either the visit from St. Nick or the night before Christmas. Those are the two main ones that are mostly used. I went into a little bit of detail at the beginning of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles because we actually one of the buildings that Steve Martin's character runs past was the building that the author, who's known as Clement Clark Moore, he lived there. So we talked a little bit about that. So I'm not going to go too much into it, but basically, there's a little bit of a dispute as to who the author is. It could either be Clement Clark Moore or Henry Livingston Jr., but it was first published on December 23rd, 1823 in the Troy Sentinel newspaper in upstate New York. So as I mentioned, it's either referred to as A Visit from St. Nick or The Night Before Christmas. I'm not going to go through the whole thing now because there's like 56 lines of it. Most people know it, as you said. You can easily look it up because we're not really going to. But the idea is that the way that Theo gives off this information as to everything that's going on here, he does it in the same tonnage that people usually read the poem in. That really works. So is there anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
I had two other items. One is back at the beginning of the minute when I thought it was really good editing how they were using Argyle's situation as a tension breaker for the obvious buildup to a battle. The music's getting more and more intense, but then we cut to Argyle and the music mellows out and you're expecting the battle to start any second because the cops are coming in now and that they're getting their guns ready. And you're like, oh, the battle's going to start, but then it cuts to Argyle. And so it's like, it's almost like you're building up the tension to the battle at the same time that they're breaking the tension. And I think the editing in this minute is really well done and does a really good job with that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think though that part of it is to also remind us, they want to constantly remind us throughout the movie that Argyle is stuck in the basement because he's needed later. They don't want it to be that we left Argyle at minute 20 and the next time we see him is minute 132.
You don't want to turn him into Chekhov's limo driver.
Exactly. That's right. That's definitely true. All right.
I'm going to assume that you've already discussed this with previous guests. So if you have, that's quite all right. But I just want to be 100% sure. Has it already been discussed that the actor that plays Eddie looks like Huey Lewis's twin brother?
Not only has it been mentioned, it okay, was whoa, yes. It was mentioned by my guest who is doing he's a documentary director who has been tailing Huey Lewis for I think 3 years doing a Huey Lewis documentary. So
that is awesome.
So if anyone would notice that it looks like Huey Lewis, Kurt was the right person for that.
Perfect. I have always referred to Eddie's character simply as Huey Lewis. I don't even ever call him Eddie.
Very cool. Very cool. Are there any other characters that you refer to by different names because they look like someone else? There's a reason I'm bringing this up because there is someone that I constantly refer to, and I love going back to him as much as possible throughout this entire podcast, even though he's last shown in like minute 16 or something like that.
Nothing is coming to mind.
So the first security guard in the lobby looked to me like John Larroquette. So I always refer
The
to him
one
as John
who like
Lovegren.
first lets him into the building, like he's
Yes.
first talking to them.
Yeah, the one who talks about finding your zipper. That's what I would refer to. Yes. So the script. All right. So there aren't that many differences here, but I found two that are pretty interesting. Okay. First of all, is the description of it shows interior the vault door. Christoph drills away, is rewarded with the message, fifth lock deactivated. Do you wish to continue? Nearby, Theo sits at a bank of monitors. Screen after screen pinpoints all the police activity outside, down to the last detail. Theo smiles. So I like the fact that in the script they mention that just because Theo is now dealing with the police outside, Christoph, who is apparently his assistant, is still working. So it's not as if they've stopped trying to get through these locks. So I like that added touch. And then the last line of this paragraph says, suddenly we recognize the tune that he's been whistling all along. He's been whistling, singing in the rain. Now, I don't know if that's true. It doesn't to me, I couldn't figure that out when I was listening to what he was humming, but at least that's what they wanted him to be humming in the script.
I wonder if Clarence Gilliard didn't know "Singing in the Rain," and so, or didn't know it well enough, so he was like, "Oh yeah, sure, let me hum that, sure."
I'll just hum Top Gun, right, so every Tuesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition, where my guest will give a little anecdote story about some sort of adventure, misadventure, or something that happened to him over the course of the holidays at some point of his life. So, Eric, you have a story for us?
So this isn't necessarily a story. It's more of just a fun memory.
Fun
My
memories are good
family,
too.
we don't really do Hanukkah anymore since I was a kid. But there is one Hanukkah that stands out the most to me from when I was a kid, and that's because my parents got me the Millennium Falcon, the old Kenner from, the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. Millennium Falcon was my Hanukkah gift that year, and that is the greatest holiday gift I've ever received in my entire life, as anyone of our generation can certainly understand.
Yeah, I get a lot of Star Wars figures for Hanukkah over the years, for sure. I'm definitely up there with you. I never got the Millennium Falcon. The closest, I think the only transport that I ever got, or any only ship that I ever got was the Imperial transport from The Empire Strikes Back, where you have the guy sitting on the outside. And like it opens up and you can put guys on the inside also. And it's something that you can see in the movie for like a fraction of a second, on off. And I always had a lot of pride that was the one thing I got, because it was a troop transport. You can open up the two doors and put a driver and a co-pilot, or a pilot and a co-pilot in, and then you had like six slots on the side to put different men on there, and then you can open up the back and put a whole, like, just stuff as many of them in there as you want. So yeah. Oh wow. Yeah. If your wife hears this story, she might now think of something better to give you for Hanukkah, next year. You never know. All right. So you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you, Eric?
Sure. So I'm the co-host of Escape from New York and Flash Minute and Flash Gordon Minute, and both have Facebook pages, both have Twitter feeds, so you can certainly contact us through there, and you can listen to both shows on any of your favorite podcatchers.
All right, excellent. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher that you find this show on. And while you're doing that, you can find me by just doing a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you find me on Twitter, and you can go directly to my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.